you're nervous and your legs aren't working the way they usually do, that can be a problem. Watch here. He's got a nice knee bend on his right leg, but does not go all the way back with his left leg, not getting the height or the spring that he's used to. He just was a little bit tight on all the jumps.
And lost some time there, so now just a tenth ahead as Shiffrin manages the final few gates here and tries to get it across the line and take over the top spot. Mikayla Shiffrin looking for another gold. No! 8/100ths behind Golubar. There will be no gold medal in the slalom in these games for Shiffrin.
Americans Mikayla Shiffrin and Nathan Chen both struggled with the pressure at the Olympic Games in South Korea. How can athletes best deal with that kind of stress? We're going to talk with a sports psychologist later on in the show. First, though, let's go to Washington, where independent counsel Robert Mueller has handed up his first indictment for meddling in the 2016 election. That indictment charges 13 Russians and three Russian organizations with conspiring to mislead Americans through social media, spending money, and forming relationships intended to illegally influence the vote. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein briefed reporters at the Justice Department.
This indictment serves as a reminder that people are not always who they appear to be on the internet. The indictment alleges that the Russian conspirators want to promote discord in the United States and undermine public confidence in democracy. We must not allow them to succeed.
Well, Jonathan Weissman is Deputy Washington Editor for the New York Times. Welcome back.
I'm happy to be here.
Okay, who are these Russians? What were they doing according to this indictment?
Well, it's a remarkable story. I mean, we always knew that there was this troll farm, this internet research agency working out of St. Petersburg, that was sending out Twitter bots, coming up with Facebook posts, Facebook articles, Facebook ads, trying to influence the election. But what we see in this indictment, and I really recommend that everybody read it. It is 37 pages of riveting text, and I'm not kidding. Is that the organization wasn't just, you know, a bunch of guys sitting by their computers. They were sending people into the United States. They were infiltrating the heartland. They were recruiting Americans to help out with their tasks. They were approaching the Trump campaign, usually incognito. They certainly weren't saying we're Russians. And they were organizing rallies. They were doing remarkable things. And this goes back to 2013. This was an incredibly systematic operation, and we really didn't see how systematic it was until we just got this Mueller indictment.
And does the indictment say that this was intended to throw the election to Donald Trump?
You know, it doesn't say it in those words, but you cannot come away from reading this without believing that. The fact is that the vast majority of the efforts that they were doing were to promote Trump or to denigrate Hillary Clinton, or to promote votes for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate who was obviously taking votes away from Hillary Clinton. Virtually everything really was geared toward Trump's election until the election itself, and then you saw this kind of mayhem that the Russians were trying to create. Because after the election, after he was the duly elected president-elect, then they started organizing protests and counter-protests for and against Trump. So the Russians definitely were trying to sow discord in any way they could.
Interesting. Well, are there any people named in this indictment on the American side who had associations with the Trump campaign?
There is one character we'd never heard of him until this. It was just a kind of a lowly guy in Southern California. He was named as a conspirator because he was the guy who was facilitating a lot of the payments and kind of going around ordinary structures. He was stealing identities, and he was helping the Russians channel money into and out of the United States.
And does the indictment say that this was done pretty much at the behest of Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin?
No, and you know it's interesting because obviously some of those indicted are close henchmen of Putin's, but nowhere in the indictment does it actually mention the Russian government. These are about individuals close to Putin, but not actually in the Kremlin.
So what does this mean? Because these are Russians, so they're presumably not here in the United States. Will they be brought to the U.S. for trial?
You know, almost certainly not. I would not think that the Russians were going to facilitate their transfer. Rod Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, said that they would go through ordinary channels to see if they could extradite these individuals. I wouldn't be holding my breath. I think this is a way of the Special Counselor Mueller really laying out everything he knows. And I'll tell you, this is not the end of it. Remember, this is detailing how the Russians used social media and rallies and in-person things to try to stir things up. But it did not talk about some of the very important parts of his probe, which is the DNC hack, the hack of the Democratic National Committee, the hack of John Podesta, the Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. So we have a ways to go here. Anyone who's saying this does or does not exonerate the Trump campaign, I think is jumping the gun.
Jonathan Weissman, Deputy Washington Editor for The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the failure to pass immigration legislation this week will affect people facing deportation. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Senate voted on four immigration bills this week, including a bipartisan plan and also President Trump's proposal. All of them failed. The president signaled he would veto the bipartisan bill that had the most support and which would likely have passed had he indicated that he would sign it. Now, the March 5th deadline to begin deporting DACA recipients whose visas have expired looms. Annabelle Krishnan used to be on DACA, but she got a green card a couple of years ago. Her two cousins, though, are on DACA, and her brother and parents are undocumented. They are completely in limbo. Annabelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your reaction to the end of the week and what did not happen in Washington?
When it failed with the Senate, I wasn't too surprised because a lot of the things that were being proposed by the administration were not things that aligned to the protection of immigrants. So for the time being, not surprised, but also disappointed.
So what does it mean, though, practically for your cousins, for the rest of your family?
So for my cousins especially, both of them have younger children, so I know it's a bit of a concern for them. But for the time being, all they can really do is just be there for their family and continue working and doing what they've always done.
And when does their status expire?
From what I know, one of my cousins, she just renewed it, so she has it for a little bit more than a year. And my other cousin she tried to renew it, but she hasn't gotten any feedback yet. So right now, hers is, I believe, going to expire midway through this year.
And meanwhile, your parents are undocumented completely.
That's right.
Right. And are they afraid they're going to be deported?
Absolutely. So last year, I was a huge advocate for DAPA, which protected the parents of children brought here. It didn't fail. It was just sort of, it came to no conclusion. They really started to take a look at themselves and see what their plan B is. They've actually considered self-deporting and actually retiring early and have considered moving back to their country.
To Mexico?
Yes.
And your cousins, how old were they when they came here?
One of my cousins, she was a baby. She was, I believe, 10 months old. I was less than a year old when I came, and my other cousin, I believe she was 5.
Okay, so maybe she remembers Mexico, but certainly you and your cousin who was 10 months old don't remember mm-hmm. any other country, right?
Exactly. We all identify as Americans. You want to have a livelihood and happiness where you are, but with everything that's happening and even raids happening, even in Los Angeles, a lot of times you do have this fear that perhaps you have to start all over.
Mm. Well, you're okay because you have a green card, right?
That is true for now. Although, you know, I have a bit of a relief of having the green card. You know, this is still something really difficult for me and my family and friends, people that I know that, you know, are trying to do better for themselves. And although a lot of these court orders and judges and this back and forth can be really exhausting, I think one reason why I still talk about this and share my story and those of others is that there's still hope. And I really hope that people listening to this, those who have the ability to vote, can really go out there during the midterm elections and really have their voices heard and speak for those that can't.
Is your fiancé an American citizen?
Yes.
So if you get married, you can become an American citizen or go through that process, right?
If it was through that process, yes.
Yeah. Annabel Krishnan is a former DACA recipient. She is now a green card holder. Annabel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here in Los Angeles, the immigration debate has been particularly tense over the past few days. ICE launched a new immigration sweep. At least 100 people have been detained so far. And last night, a group of activists blocked an ICE van from accessing the Metropolitan Detention Center in downtown LA. Well, Rabbi Aria Cohen was there, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, describe that scene. You were there. What was it like?
So we were there. Essentially, we were reacting to the fact that ICE had mass deportation raids this week. They arrested detained 100 people. And so we went out to the Metropolitan Detention Center to demand that ICE stop that, stop destroying families and communities. As we were there, we saw an ICE van, from a DHS ICE van, trying to get into the center. It's one of the vans, a type of van that is used to transport undocumented detainees. And so a group of us just decided that tonight they weren't going to get into the Metropolitan Detention Center, and we stood around the van for a number of hours.
And then what happened?
And then the LAPD came, they closed off the street, and they told us that if we did not disperse, they would begin arresting us. And after a couple of warnings, most people, well, we went home. Uh-huh. We dispersed. Stopping the ICE detention van was not an initial goal of the action, but I think it'll start happening more and more. I think people are tired and angry and upset about the fact that ICE is taking upon itself in these retaliatory raids, which are specifically retaliatory, in Los Angeles and around the country, arresting activists and arresting people who have no criminal background and are just here trying to support their families and their communities and make a better life for themselves. I think more and more people are getting tired of this type of activity by ICE. And we'll be, as they say, you know, throwing more and more sticks into the spokes and putting their bodies on the machinery.
Are you saying that they are deliberately targeting people who are speaking out, who are undocumented?
They are. There are specific cases in New York and in Chicago and here in Los Angeles. Just about a half a year ago, a woman who was an immigration rights activist who spoke out when her mother was detained, was then herself detained with a clean record, a dreamer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, and the national head of ICE warned Los Angeles, saying that if you don't cooperate, we're going to come after you. We see this as explicitly retaliatory, which is no way to conduct a democratic country.
Well, of course, they would say, look, we're just doing our job. Our job is to prevent undocumented immigrants from being here, to deport people who are not allowed to be here legally. And that's the law. We're following the law.
They're saying that. They're also saying that they're only going after people who have criminal backgrounds. And that's obviously not true on its face by all records. Also, this country benefits from their labor, from their contributing to the project of creating a more just society. Pastor Noe, who was a pastor in an evangelical community, has been in the country for 25 years, served his community and was arrested, was detained. He was ultimately released, or Agalico, who has been in the country for 30 years and has no, has a clean record and was detained. These are the types of people who are being detained. ICE says, it claims that they're going after people with criminal records, but they also say, as a caveat, that if they come across people who don't have criminal records, they're going to detain them also, which gives them free license.
Right. And so in other parts of the country, we're seeing some churches open up as sanctuary mm-hmm. places for undocumented immigrants who are at risk of being deported. Why isn't that happening here?
It is. There's two types of sanctuary. There's sanctuary that's announced and there's sanctuary that's not announced. There are, I personally know that there are churches and temples that are giving sanctuary to undocumented immigrants. It's up to the undocumented person whether or not they want to go public with their sanctuary, because that, of course, heightens the risk. The prayer community that I'm part of is supporting financially somebody who's in sanctuary. So I know that it's spread around L.A. and people are doing it. People, their communities, both Jewish, Christian, Muslim, who are either taking in physically or supporting people, recognizing that people who are here, who have been here for many, many years and are either the family that we're supporting is a mother and daughter who came from Central America. The son in the family was killed in gang violence. If they go back, the threat of death. So that's not sending them back to that kind of a situation is not what this city is supposed to be about or this country is supposed to be about.
And you're keeping it secret where they are because you're afraid ICE will come?
Correct. They don't have asylum yet. Yeah, they're working through asylum hearings.
But ICE isn't allowed to come into a place of worship and detain someone.
Correct. Not all these people are physically in places of worship.
Okay. So they're in people's houses or something like that.
Correct.
What's next for your group and for this protest movement?
So Congress failed yesterday to come to some kind of an immigration reform. And it's now we are asking them, we're asking the president. The president created this problem with the Dreamers by rescinding DACA. And our question is, what are you going to do about it? And that's what we're going to press that question. There are 800,000 people who came here under the DREAM Act, and there are their families and millions of others who are here. And our question is, what are you going to do about it? And we're going to keep pressing that question in town halls, in the street, in the offices of elected officials. We are going to say, how are you going to solve this problem?
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Rabbi Arya Cohen. He's on the board of Clergy and Laity United for Economic Justice, and he's also rabbi in residence at Bend the Ark, a Jewish partnership for justice. And we asked ICE for a comment on these allegations of retaliatory raids and arrests, and they said that of the 212 people arrested in the L.A. area in the past week, 88% were convicted criminals. And they added, ICE does not target unlawfully present aliens for arrest based on advocacy positions they hold or in retaliation for critical comments they make. Any suggestion to the contrary, ICE says, is irresponsible, speculative, and inaccurate. Okay, we have one more story about ICE, and this one is from Seattle. It is a wild one. The top ICE attorney in Seattle has admitted to stealing the identities of immigrants and using them to open credit cards and receive personal loans. He's pleaded guilty and resigned from his position. He's expected to be sentenced in May. Gene Johnson is an AP reporter in Seattle. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, so this former ICE agent, his name is Rafael Sanchez, and what exactly did he do?
Well, beginning in 2013, he began basically stealing the identities of immigrants in various stages of deportation or other proceedings. He would use his work computer to forge identities in their names after looking through their alien files, their official immigration files, and taking their personal information. In some cases, he was creating Social Security cards in their names and getting driver's license in their names, and then he would use that information to to take out credit cards or open bank accounts in their names.
And then what would he do with that money?
Well, it's not totally clear. He took about $190,000. There's very limited information that's been made public about how he was spending the money. And we also don't really know what prompted him to do this. There hasn't, no information has come out about his motives. It's possible we might hear more when he is sentenced in May.
And how many immigrants did he target?
The plea documents say that he stole the identities of at least seven. However, investigators say they found personal information or documents on about 20 others at his house when they searched it.
Wow. And so he, I guess, was banking on the fact that they were going to be deported, so how could they complain? Or that they didn't have papers, so they wouldn't complain anyway. How was he caught?
We don't know how he was caught. The investigators haven't said. The Justice Department's public integrity section has not hasn't said, except that the Justice Department did say in a statement that ICE brought this to their attention. They say that ICE uncovered it promptly and referred it for prosecution. But he had been doing it for about 4 years at that point.
Oh, wow. And so some of them had already been deported, right?
Some of them had were either in deportation proceedings. Some of them were already overseas, not because they had necessarily been deported, but because they had abandoned their legal permanent resident status, you know, such as by moving back to China in one case. But the investigators say that a lot of that some of these victims had no idea what he had been doing, had no idea that their credit was essentially being ruined.
And this wasn't just some run-of-the-mill ICE agent. This guy was a lead attorney, right?
He was the chief counsel for ICE in Seattle. He basically was in charge of their legal operations for Washington, Alaska, Idaho, and Oregon.
Wow. So what is ICE saying about all this?
ICE says that this was an isolated and egregious case, that he betrayed the public trust, and that they continue to have faith in the work that the rest of the office is doing in Seattle.
Hmm. Okay. Gene Johnson, AP reporter in Seattle. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, it's our Friday film review segment, and really, is there any other movie to talk about?
Yes, believe the hype. The film is excellent.
Black Panther, our review, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and finally.
My son, it is your time.
Show me my respect and bow down.
You get to decide what kind of king you are going to be.
Well, large crowds turned out already last night for Marvel's Black Panther. The movie is one of Fandango's top five pre-sellers of all time. And now it's time for movie reviews. Katie Walsh is here. She reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back.
Hi.
And Jacqueline Coley. She contributes to blackgirlnerds.com and co-hosts the Rotten Tomatoes show See It, Skip It. Welcome back to you.
Glad to be back.
Okay, we're going to wait a little bit longer to get your reviews of Black Panther and begin with Early Man. This stars Tom Hiddleston, Eddie Redmayne, and it's a bit of a counter-programming to Black Panther. This is a stop-motion animated movie.
Chief! Whoa, 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 whoa. Ah! Time to go hunting!
Bit early, isn't it, Doug?
Right, grab a spear.
Oh, it's pointy.
Okay, Katie, you saw this one. What is
this
about?
So this is a film from Aardman Animations, who are the studio, the British animation studio who did Wallace and Gromit and Chicken Run. So they do claymation And it's definitely their style. It's very British. It's tons of British humor. It is a story that spans the Stone Age to the Bronze Age. And it's about these cavemen in the Stone Age who suddenly get invaded by these Bronze Age guys. The villain is played by Tom Hiddleston. He plays a character named Lord Newth. And he discovers that they love football, or soccer, if you will, and so he challenges them to a match. So it sort of goes from Clan of the Cave Bear to the Bad News Bears. And nice. He teaches his cavemen buddies how to play soccer and brings in a girl from a city who's not allowed to play. And then they challenge the great team to a match and win their valley back. But it's, you know, it's Aardman, so it's got very sort of like dry humor and lots of jokes, lots of little visual jokes. And it plays on all these sports movie tropes, but they have a lot of, you know, British soccer Man United type of jokes as well. It's a really cute movie. It's very efficient, very well paced. It like comes in at 89 minutes. It's a great one to take like the little kids to who might be a little bit too young for Black Panther.
So this is a little kid movie.
Yeah, but at the same time, like it's really smart and adults can totally have a good time too.
So is it basically like Stone Age, the simpler times, better than the corrupting modern times
yes.
of the Bronze Age?
There's definitely a story about the redistribution of wealth and the corrupting power of money and sort of like, you know, not being greedy and hoarding all the money for the 1% because, you know, they're selling tickets to the match and Lord Newth is greedy. He loves his money and his gold, his shiny gold or bronze, if you will.
And Wallace and Gromit was delightful.
Oh, yeah. And it's totally in that vein. It's really cute. So it's a fun movie.
Okay, yeah. Good. All right. Let's get to the
Let's get to the good stuff.
Let's get to the main dish yeah. this weekend. Okay. Black Panther. Let's just play another clip.
I waited my entire life for this. The world's gonna start over. I'ma burn it all. What happens now determines what happens to the rest of the world.
Okay, Black Panther, about the mythical African kingdom of Wakanda, hidden from the world, but discovered, and then, well...
I just want to go back to Wakanda. I just listened to that clip. I'm like dancing in my seat. So, yeah. So Marvel's Black Panther, this is the 18th film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's Ryan Coogler's shot at Black Panther. T'Challa, who we got introduced to in Civil War, and we basically take a trip to Wakanda. This takes place minutes after the events of Civil War. T'Challa has lost his father. He's taken up the mantle of Black Panther. And the film really centers around the politics and the reality of him as a man, as a politician, as a king, and all of these factions that make up the Wakandan world. We get our first real glimpse of what the world of Wakanda is, which it's a secretive nation that is built its wealth and technology upon this vibranium metal. That's what Captain America's shield is made out of. It's what all of his tech and his suit is made out of. And we meet him and his family, which is sort of littered around him are these really amazing, fierce feminine women, his sister Shuri, Okoye, the general of his guard, his mother Ramunda, and his love interest Nakia, played by Lupita Nyong'o. And I can't talk enough about how visually stunning this film is, both from a production and costume design. I mean, what Ryan Coogler did, if you're a person that maybe doesn't like superhero films, this is, I think, going to be an entry point for you because it is completely separate from any other superhero film that you will see. It is a movie with a message, and it really doesn't pull a lot of punches. Mm.
So it has been compared to James Bond in some ways. How so?
I mean, it's very much a globe-trotting adventure. I mean, T'Challa is essentially tasked with protecting Wakanda. And so sometimes he has to venture out, in this case, to Korea to try and, you know, thwart out these, you know, villainous foes played by Ulysses Klaue, played by Andy Serkis. They're trying to essentially get what Wakandans have, which is vibranium. It's the most precious metal in the United States. And so, you know, there's a lot of forces out there that don't necessarily want it all in that one resource.
And so you loved it.
I did love it.
Katie, what'd you think?
Oh, my God. I had a hard time, like, forming words after I saw Black Panther because I just loved it so much that I was like, I don't even know how to describe how much I love this movie. And going back to the Bond point, I do think that his sister, Shuri, played by Letitia Wright, she's a little bit of his Q. Mm-hmm. She's like the technology whiz who sort of is like, here's this cool suit and here's this cool thing.
So there are gadgets.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Yes. Lots of gadgets, lots of tech. And, yeah, so, you know, I will say that Chadwick Boseman, who plays Black Panther, very classily lets himself be completely upstaged by everybody else in this movie.
Yes.
Danai Gurira, who plays Okoye, the general of the guard, steals this movie out from everyone. She's amazing. And then also Michael B. Jordan, who plays Eric Killmonger, the villain, or one of the villains, he is amazing. He is like the best villain because he is sexy and charismatic, and but you also root for him. He's a little bit like Bane in The Dark Knight Rises, like someone who's been very oppressed and wants to liberate himself and liberate his people by any means necessary. So he has very like extreme radical revolutionary views, and essentially he wants to wage war. But Black Panther, T'Challa, he is like, I have to protect Wakanda. I have to.
I mean, it's a Martin and Malcolm story in a lot of ways.
Exactly,
they're very much opposing forces. And the thing
and
about
Martin Luther King, Malcolm X.
Yeah, Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. And you know, and to a certain respect, as the king, you know, he's taking the Martin Luther King mantle of like, we have to work within the global community. And then again, Killmonger, who is an American, we'll just say that he's an American and leave it at that. But his whole, I guess, mantra is because of all of the things, the racial injustices that affect Americans. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of different to put this one country that's been far removed from colonialism and from the yoke of slavery to see how they advance without any of that influence to this pinnacle of Black excellence. And then the flip side of that is the Killmonger character. And you see why they have different
ideologies. Is it problematic to equate Killmonger with Malcolm X as a villain?
I mean,
He's technically a villain, but you root for him. You are like on his side. And by the end of the film, they reconcile everything with his character. But I mean, he is that type of charismatic character. And he is like Michael B. Jordan is like at a roiling boil, just like underneath the surface the whole time. He is so, like an electrical live wire. Like you cannot take your eyes off of him because he makes his pain of being oppressed in America so real and so palpable that you are like, yes, I'm on his side. Like, let's do this. But
what makes
at the same time, they're trying to balance out with like protecting Wakanda and not being a war-mongering nation.
Yeah. What makes him the villain is not his aim. It's his tactics. That is the simplest way to put it, because what he's trying to achieve is universal and understandable given everything that is put front and foremost, like racial inequality, being over-policed and incarcerated, the reality of the Black experience both in America and in many other countries. Ryan Coogler did not pull any punches when he kind of dissected that in this. And I'm just completely grateful to Disney and Marvel for having the gumption and the sort of convictions to put this film out there, because it's very unflinching. And
I will say I'm really happy to hear that, because I wasn't that excited about Creed. Like, I thought that was kind of, I don't know, by the books and not that interesting as a movie, as opposed to Fruitvale.
Okay. As opposed to Fruitvale, I can give you that. I did still love Creed.
I love Creed.
I did. Like, I just want to jump up and down.
I'm also happy to hear, because I was afraid that all the hype would, nothing could live up to that.
Believe the hype.
The hype is, and I even wrote on this, that the hype is difficult, but yes, believe the hype. The film is excellent. I definitely think that people are going to be hard-pressed to put it higher in the Marvel Cinematic Universe or find a film that's higher. Currently at 98%, maybe 97%. I didn't check
it this
morning.
But what if you don't like Marvel? What if you're not a superhero?
It's not, I would say, it's like for me, I'm sort of so-so on Marvel. I find them to be very formulaic. This feels very auteurist. Ryan Coogler's point of view is very strong in this film. And It feels like a standalone movie. It doesn't, like, I don't even want to call it like a Marvel movie so much. Like, I find that a lot of those Marvel movies end on like a giant spaceship and everyone's going to fall off the spaceship or something, or it's going to crash. And this is like very grounded, very real, very individual. The point of view is very much Ryan Coogler, and it is an auteurist film, and they let him do what he wanted to do.
That is very much evident. I don't think anybody else would have made this Marvel film. And then to your point, too, I mean, this is a war to save Wakanda, not to save the world. And most Marvel movies are to save the world. Mm-hmm. And so for that, it is a complete departure in a
lot
of ways.
Will there be a sequel?
I mean,
definitely. Definitely.
Let me put these numbers out because I have to. I think it's projecting right now at a $170 million opening weekend. It did $25 million on previews. Yeah, they're going to make a sequel.
Are you guys going to see it again?
Oh, definitely.
Well, I'm currently at viewing number 3.
Wow.
But yes. Okay. I was blessed, thankfully, to catch it at the world premiere, which I also have to add, every Black celebrity from here to everywhere was there. I'm saying Issa Rae, Ava DuVernay, Bill Bellamy. Like, I saw Bellamy.
Speaking of Ava DuVernay, why did she turn this down?
So,
to direct,
you know,
it?
I don't know. I don't read Ava's mind, but I do know this. They couldn't come to a meeting of minds, is what both of them have come to say, mm-hmm, about the vision of the film. What I like to think in my internal fan fiction is the film that she pitched, Marvel maybe wasn't ready to hear it.
Oh.
And because remember this, Ryan Coogler has been very public. He turned them down twice before he agreed to do it. So maybe it took, you know, the certain number of no's before they realized, like, if you're going to make this Black Panther movie and you're going to get a high caliber director to direct it, you're going to have to let them direct their own movie.
So maybe she'll do the sequel.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears.
Jacqueline Coley contributes to blackgirlnerds.com and blackfilm.com and co-hosts the Rotten Tomatoes show See It, Skip It. Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, how athletes can bend under incredible pressure. Exhibit A, Nathan Chen. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Since well before the Olympics began, American figure skater Nathan Chen was deemed a fan favorite, sure to medal in Pyeongchang.
I think that over the past couple years, I have definitely proved myself as one of the top U.S. men, if not the top U.S. man.
What the 5 was?
Last year was definitely a huge moment for me.
Bow down to Nathan Chen.
But yesterday, Chen fell on his opening quadruple lutz and stumbled through the rest of his program. Tara Lipinski and the other judges were shocked.
He can do these quad lutzes in his sleep. There's no reason he couldn't have landed that. It's just a lot of pressure.
Well, that pressure seems to have hit alpine skier Michaela Schifrin, too. She reportedly threw up before her slalom run and came in fourth. She was expected to win gold. Goes to show that even Olympians can freeze up from performance anxiety. Melissa Todd is here now. She's a sports psychologist who works with high-level athletes. Hi.
Hi. Nice to be with you today.
Well, great to be with you. So what do you see when you see these two high-level athletes just blow it?
Well, I see something that just about every athlete has to go through at some time in their career, dealing with the pressures and having an incident of choking under pressure. Every athlete, no matter what level you're at, has experienced that at one time or another, and it's one of the things that goes along with being a high-level athlete.
Yeah. So how do you prepare them so that doesn't happen often?
Well, I think that there are a number of things that athletes can do to try to minimize the possibility that that's going to happen. And so much of it is about putting yourself in high-pressured situations repeatedly, essentially exposure therapy. You pressure yourself often and you get used to it and become desensitized over time. So the more you can put yourself in that situation, the better it's going to be for you typically. And we also encourage athletes to have pre-performance routines that they practice even before training sessions so that it becomes a conditioned response to relax before performing. And we also encourage them to have performance cues where they will oftentimes have a word or a phrase that they repeat that helps to relax them, put them in the right mindset. It might be something as simple as relax. It might be focus. But essentially, it really just comes down to putting themselves in high-pressure situations over and over again.
And by high-pressure situations, you mean actually doing their sport in front of people for a medal or for some kind of prize that's worth something.
Absolutely. I mean, going to competitions as much as they're able to within their sport, that repetition of having to get through what it's like to be in that high-pressure situation, because it's uncomfortable, frankly. And every athlete, when they're out there performing, they're alone, and they have to deal with it on their own. And so each athlete has to figure out how to do that. And, you know, unfortunately, it's difficult to deal with the physiological sensations that happen in your body, and it can come up at any given time. Like you used the example of Michaela Schifrin, throwing up before she skied, and as accomplished as she is, it might have been a surprise for her that that happened, but it can happen at any time.
Hmm. Well, you know, both of them, Michaela Schifrin and Nathan Chen, were, you know, they got so much coverage as the darlings, the Olympic darlings for the U.S. And so what does that do to them? I mean, they must be used to it on a certain level, but the Olympics just probably added more to that. How do you counsel athletes to try to put the media coverage in perspective?
Well, in some ways, I mean, you know, it's sort of like putting on the blinders. What I encourage athletes to do is to identify the very few things that they have the most control over. And it's really very few things. You know, it's their behavior, their choices, the way that they think. And that's about it. And to learn how to filter everything else out, put on blinders, turn on the filter. It's sort of like being able to tune out white noise. And so that's a lot of the way that I ask them to think about those external pressures, is it's sort of like white noise. And when it's time to perform, you have to learn to tune it out. Mm-hmm. But as you can imagine, it's very, very difficult. Not very many of us have our successes and failures broadcast, you know, nationally and internationally on such a huge stage.
Yeah, and at such a young age. Melissa Todd is a sports psychologist who works with high-level athletes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the U.S. women's hockey team might need a little help with their bruised psyches today. They lost a nail-biter against arch-rival Canada yesterday, and here to tell us more is our resident Norwegian winter sports guru, Press Play producer Christian Bordahl. Hi.
Hey there.
How was that game yesterday?
It was a great, great hockey game. It was so exciting, beautiful to watch, powerful, free-flowing, great passing, take-no-prisoners defense. It was just an exciting, wonderful hockey game. The U.S. women were all over the Canadians, and they even outshot them 45-23, so they had almost twice as many shots on goal. Unfortunately, the only ones that count are the ones that actually go in. Yes, and
so they lost 2-1.
They lost 2-1, yeah.
Okay, are they out now? Is that it for
them? No, this was a group play game. Both of these teams are going to go on to semifinals, and they're almost certain to meet again in the final.
So are they the two best teams in women's
hockey?
They are,
by far. In international women's hockey, they are in a league of their own. They've met in every world championship final. It's been Canada versus the U.S. And in fact, the U.S. has beaten Canada the last four times in the world championships, including last year in April. But it's a different story in the Olympics. In the Olympics, they have also met, with one exception, they've met in every final, and it's Canada that's winning all of those. Canada has, in fact, won every Olympic gold since women first started in hockey, except for the first year, which was in Nagano in 1998, when they lost to the U.S.
Hmm.
So I wonder if maybe they're getting into the heads of the U.S. players just a little bit.
Yeah, they need some sports psychologists
exactly.
to help them out there.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the players on the team actually is from this area, this part of the world,
she
in Riverside.
Is. Yeah.
Tell us about her.
Kayla Barnes just turned 19 last month. She's the youngest player on the team, defenseman or defensewoman or whatever you say. Tiny, barely 5 feet, really fast, great puck handler, and she has been playing really well in these games.
And you talked to her?
I did. I talked to her before they went off, and I asked her about this Canadian rivalry because she had played in a game against Canada as a kind of warm-up for the Sochi Olympics. The U.S. lost 5-2, and I asked her about that game, and here's what she had to say.
They're a great team, and you know, they deserve to win that game, and we could be better, and we should be better against them, and I think that next time if when we do face them again, I think we will be better because so many people on this team want this this dream and of the Olympics so bad.
Okay, so how does a girl from Riverside end up playing hockey?
Yeah, and even end up on an Olympic team. Yeah. Well, actually, I'll let her tell that story.
I have four older brothers, so basically they played inline, and that's how I started playing inline hockey. And then they switched over to ice hockey, and when they switched over, I switched over as well. I started as a figure skater, and then after a year or so, I didn't like it, and I ended up playing hockey just like my brothers did.
Yep, and from there she went to boarding school in New Hampshire. She got recruited to Boston College, and then in her freshman year, the women's coach calls her up and says, hey, would you like to come down to Florida and train with the U.S. Olympic or the U.S. national team, which is a no-brainer, obviously. And she went off. She left college. She went down there and she made the team. And now she's playing and she's doing great.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Well, what is the status of women's hockey? Because we never hear about them. We always hear about the men.
You know, it reminds me a lot of the women's national soccer team. We've talked about that before, like how they really had to struggle to start to get parity with the men because they got
playing
paid a lot less.
And all, that.
All of that stuff. Yeah. Exactly. Same thing has been going on with women, perhaps even worse in hockey. And they actually threatened to boycott right before the World Championships last year, and it looked like they weren't even going to play. And then at the last minute, U.S. hockey kind of caved and said, okay, and they came up with a much better deal, and so now they're much better off.
Okay.
And there is, in fact, a U.S. Women's Pro Hockey League now, but there are only four teams, so it's very nascent.
Okay, speaking of nascent,
yes.
We need to talk about, this is switching gears a little bit, about the cross-country skier from Mexico who had never skied.
I knew this was going to happen.
It was just incredible. He didn't win, in fact.
He came last. Yes.
Herman
he took twice
Madrazo.
As long to get around the track as
all but he's like a hero. Tell
he
us about
him.
He
is a hero. You know, it's funny. He and the guy, the famous shirtless Tongan, Peter Taufatofua, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them actually traveled around together, spent all of their own money and everything they had, basically, to be able to qualify for the Olympics. They had to go and do a bunch of events, you know, to qualify. And ESPN actually talked to Madrazo about it, and I love this quote from him. He said, Peter and I spent 2 months fighting and fighting every day. One day we were completely out of money and we had one last chocolate bar. There was nothing left, and we split that chocolate bar and said, well, brother, we live to fight another day.
Well, and that's then amazing. He only, I think he had just enough money to buy a one-way ticket
to Iceland
for a race
It was his last chance to qualify for the Olympics, and he made it there in Iceland, but he only had enough money for one-way ticket to call his family to get him home to Mexico.
Well, it's kind of like Eddie the Eagle, right?
It is like Eddie the Eagle. He was the ski jumper that the Norwegians love to make fun of with the Coke bottle glasses and, you know, landed halfway up the hill.
There was a movie made about him, so you
never
know.
He was an inspiration. There was also this guy, Philip Boyt, who was a Kenyan who went to the Nagano Olympics, and he actually became friends with one of the most famous cross-country skiers of all time, Bjørn Dæhlie from Norway. And there was a lovely thing that happened with them. I remember watching this race, and Dæhlie won that race, and Boyt came in way after the others, and Dæhlie refused to go off to the medal ceremony. He hung out at the end finish line waiting for Boyt to come in, and then when he finally got there, he gave him a big hug. It was lovely.
Oh,
yeah.
Cross-country skiing, it brings everyone together.
It does.
Okay. Quickly, what are you looking forward to this weekend?
Well, I've got to see Lindsey Vonn. She's going to be skiing for the first time in the Super
Downhill.
G, so that's really exciting. And whatever you do, don't miss the cross-country ski relays. The U.S. women in particular, they could medal for the first time. They're great. They're so strong this year. That's going to be really exciting to watch.
Okay, great. Press Play producer, senior producer, and resident Norwegian, Christian Bordahl. Look at that mashup of your feedback music as well as the theme. That's it for Press Play this Friday and this week. Our show is directed by Sarah Sweeney, produced by Christian Bordahl, Amy Ta, Gina Pollack, Michelle Aloy, Anna Scott, Yael, Evan Orr. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Phil Richards engineered for us this week. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you next week. Have a great weekend.